Monday morning, I guess, Mark. I mean, we're here. We've got the sun out, so we haven't been obliterated by some sort of a, you know, massive, Russian attack, because Putin keeps dropping this idea that, oh, nuclear weapons are coming next. We'll see how all this goes. But I think, from the standpoint of the weekend, I certainly want to hope that everyone had a wonderful Mother's Day out there, if you've got your mom still here. And if you're married and you've got your wife and, making sure that day was a special day. I did say in my message to Common Sense Campaign that, you know, every day really needs to be Mother's Day for these moms who have to deal with children and running the house and,
oh, sure,
and trying to do all of that and still have a job. This whole issue of, you know, working mother and trying to run a family, I find it absolutely incredible how people can make it happen, but they're doing it, and I think we need to recognize that more than once a year. I'll tell you that. So that's just me saying my view about that, but I do think that really at our family we had a really good day with my wife, and she was feeling good. She's in, her health is always an issue, but I think yesterday she was really on top of things, and she felt really good. So we had a really nice day, and I'm really thankful for that.
Well, excellent.
Yeah. So now, what about today? What I wanted to try to do is talk a little bit about the reaction to the leaked draft memo that maybe Roe versus Wade is going to go away, and hysteria on the left that this is just going to be the darkest day in the history of the United States and blah, blah, blah. Okay? But it's more serious than just that, because the rhetoric that their leadership is using, like Schumer, you know, calling out Kavanaugh, calling out Gorsuch, you know, saying that they're going to pay a price. Well, they've already taken, you know, Justice Alito into a secure location. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I think that that's kind of over the top. But it's nothing different than what we've seen with since 2020, the summer of, and all of the use of violence to get your political points across. I think that's something that we need to kind of talk about. So I want to touch on that a little bit. Then I want to talk a little bit about the latest information we've gotten that the Pentagon is providing the Ukrainians with a degree of intelligence which has led to the death of, I think, about 10 generals, Ruski generals, which I have no problem with killing them. I got that. But nevertheless, when you tie that to intelligence that may very well have led to sinking of the cruiser Moskva, their main, you know, fleet, you know,
the flagship of the fleet,
flagship
yes.
of the fleet, then mm-hmm. it seems to me that we're kind of crossing a line that, in as much as I've said on many occasions that we're right to be doing all this, I think we have to be real careful crossing a very overt line that could very easily draw us there, and that's not where we want to go.
Well, you know? Didn't Russia cross a line when they brought over 1,000 armored vehicles across the borderline into Ukraine?
Well, sure. There's no question about that, them crossing a line, okay? But, you know, from the standpoint of where we are in terms of our relationships with NATO and with Ukraine, it seems to me that what we were trying to accomplish, you know, was important. We can't allow Putin to win here. And so what we can do through either covert means or surreptitiously is to arm the Ukrainians with as much stuff as they need, and we have been doing that much better than what Biden has been doing, you know, for the whole year prior to the invasion, which is another issue in terms of deterring the Russians from doing that. But be that as it may, my point is that I think that that we need to be very careful about where we're going with that, and I'll try to articulate that a little bit more in detail. The last thing I want to talk about this morning is what we accomplished and what we heard up at the Alabama Conservative Coalition meeting in Clanton on Saturday. We were there from 10 to about 3 in the afternoon. Heard from some really great people, Dr. David Calderwood, who is one of the concerned doctors He's a member of Concerned Doctors Alabama and was a national figure. I've mentioned him before on the show. He gave a really good talk, so I want to explain a little bit of that. We heard from Stephanie Dernan, the co-director of Health Freedom Alabama. We heard from Becky Gerritsen, executive director of Eagle Forum. We had a call in from Tim James, and we had a call in from Mo Brooks. So I think it's worthwhile, you know, just kind of talking a little about this, because we've got today is what, the 9th?
Yes.
Tomorrow's the 10th. 14 days after that, we've got the primary election. So whatever's going to happen in the next 2 weeks, you know, the conservative coalition wanted to make sure that we're moving in the right direction to support the candidates that we think are important. So that's where I wanted to go with the show today. So let's just take a minute here to look at this question about the fate of Roe versus Wade. Okay, we've had it for 50 years now, and the argument basically is that, you know, women's rights advocates and advocates for, you know, abortion are basically arguing that, you know, this is a fundamental right. Justices like Kavanaugh and others have gone before the Senate committees before their appointments and basically argued stare decisis, which is a term associated with, you know, respecting previous opinions, okay? And so, you know, over the course of the Sunday talk shows, you know, we saw Kavanaugh saying that stare decisis is important. Well, of course, what is he going to say, okay? Mm-hmm. But let's put stare decisis into a category, okay? In 1896, in Plessy versus Ferguson, it was clear that the Supreme Court basically said, well, segregation is okay. Now, if stare decisis is supposed to be the be-all, end-all of everything that's associated with the Supreme Court, then how do you square that with the Civil Rights Movement and the degree to which things changed after 1954 with Brown versus Board of Education and with the Civil Rights Acts of 64 and 65? Stare decisis is not something that means you can't change things when some of these other cases that were decided were wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just that simple. And the argument that the pro-life people are making here is that there was a question, and Alito especially launched this in this draft memo, that what happened in 1972 with the decision, or 73, you ended up creating a right that they said, a privacy right in the Constitution that essentially was a creation of the justices, okay? The argument basically being, you know, privacy is certainly there. There's no question about that. But when you take the issue of privacy and apply it to a woman's right to have an abortion, when you had states that were saying no to abortion and, you know, others who were making the point that there was no privacy right, that you've really just created this out of whole cloth, then it seems like if you're going to argue for abortion, you needed to argue on a different way, okay? But they didn't argue that way in 1973, and so what you end up getting is the creation of a privacy right that the critics are arguing, this is what Alito says, did not exist. So what are they going to do? What Alito is basically saying in the draft, if it comes to pass, is that let's turn this issue back to the states where it belonged to begin with. Let the state legislators, not nine justices, come up with, you know, how the states are going to react based on what those states want to do. States like Alabama will more than likely outlaw abortions, but other states like California, New York, other places like that, will go forward with their own version of abortion laws. Now, the fact is that according to what Schumer and Pelosi are saying, that they will try to codify Roe versus Wade in some law that they're going to try to pass or bring up this Wednesday, I understand it. So the problem for them is that they don't have the votes in the Senate to carry this, but nevertheless it'll send a statement of desire as to where they want to go. And what they want to do is try to change the political dynamic from Biden's unpopularity, the inflation issue, all the rest of the things that have brought Biden down to in the 30s, and have really turned, you know, the November election into essentially a referendum on him. And if that's the case, everyone thinks that the Democrats are going to lose big. There's going to be a tsunami, just like you saw with the Newt Gingrich election in 94 and what you saw in 2010 with Obama. So what the smart Democrats are saying, well, let's motivate our base. Let's do what we have to do. We can really get people fired up about this whole question about saving abortion and making sure that, and they keep claiming that other rights are now going to be suspect about whether or not you can marry whoever you want to marry. Again, you know, but see, I mean, these are the kinds of questions that it's a major distraction from the real world problems that we're having with inflation, with all the issues that have just brought Biden and the Democrats into a very precarious position prior to November's election. So, I mean, for them, the whole leak was essentially a benefit, because now they can turn the volume up. They can threaten the justices, which they have, and they have rhetorically threatened them. And I guess that they've got protests out there now, because someone published the locations of the house addresses of all these justices, you know, particularly the ones that are, you know, the conservatives, and they happen to be, five of them happen to be Catholic. So you've got this religious connection to it, and of course the Catholic Church has always been opposed to abortion. How in the world do Catholics allow people like Biden to go to communion is another issue. But I mean, the hypocrisy here is absurd, but nevertheless, this is a, you know, it is become a Catholic issue when it's not necessarily a Catholic issue. It's a human rights question, and the degree to which the issue of whether a fetus has rights. And the argument on the pro-life side is that basically they do at conception. The argument on the other side is that the woman's right to have an abortion is hers and hers only, and that transcends and trumps anything else. So you've got these two, you know, two differing views that have now suddenly become full focused on what this court is going to decide. And if Alito's draft goes the way it looks like it will, and again, this is another one of these issues that, you know, are these drafts a reasonable forecast of what's going to happen? Well, for the most part, pretty much so. So if that's, unless something changes, and this is what the demonstrations and the use of the techniques of possibly harming these justices is to get them to change their minds on this, which, again, let's kind of frame this along the lines of, you know, political change in a republic that traditionally has looked at these things through the lens of peaceful change. Now, how peaceful was the civil rights movement? Well, there were some problems with it, obviously. You know, the Harlem riots, Watts, you know, Detroit, other places like that. But by in the main, one can argue that the civil rights movement had peaceful protests that really brought the nation's conscience into play, that the Declaration and the Constitution had to be fully implemented for the black minority. And that was the key thing. I mean, Dr. King's Birmingham letter to the pastors of you know, America basically argued this justice cannot be delayed. We need to have the churches involved, sending this message to these people that this is the time for justice to be served. And to a very large degree, that's what happened. And I think that peaceful protest has its place, obviously. Violent protests can be a part of change, but to the degree that the civil rights movement was free from a revolutionary, you know, manifestation of violence, I think is an important thing to consider when you look at what the far left is now trying to do. And here again, this is a different time than the 60s. And even though the civil rights movement was well grounded in philosophical rights, okay, and by all accounts, you know, those philosophical rights did change the minds of the whites who were, you know, I mean, George Wallace basically standing in the door of Alabama, University of Alabama, saying segregation now and segregation forever. That didn't happen. And why didn't it happen? It was because leaders, you know, in the churches, in the public sector, you know, basically said it's time to change. Okay? Now, this question about forcing these justices into a different mindset is going to take us into something along the lines fundamentally different from the whole protest movement in the civil rights period. Okay? And the model that they're using is all along the lines of what you saw in 2020 with Antifa and Black Lives Matter protesting everything. And how did they protest? Using violence, attacking, you know, federal courts in Portland, these Democratic mayors doing nothing about it, whether it was Minneapolis, whether it was Portland, whether it's Chicago, whatever. And so the Democrats themselves have been locked into a situation where their violent base is not going to be disciplined. They're not going to suffer consequences. And the argument basically now is that, you know, here's a fundamental challenge to women's rights. And the only way that that can be protected is to carry the day through the violent reaction that Antifa and Black Lives Matter represent, and what you're seeing with these protesters going into the neighborhoods of the justices. Now, so far, it hasn't translated into burning down any houses yet. I say yet because Alito has been taken to a secure location. Now, what does that mean? It means that someone really thinks that he is in danger, he and his family. And I think that that's the kind of thing that essentially is going to create this clash, because if we're going to allow the Supreme Court to just be bullied by the mob, then at what point do we really say that this republic that we've had for over 250 years is essentially viable anymore? And again, one of the things that I saw with Fareed Zakaria this morning, or yesterday morning, was this whole question about the polarization within the country. Okay, now I'm not going to spend the rest of the show on this. Okay, but I will just tease you with it for a little bit, and we'll come back to it. But the Zakaria argument basically is that secularization has undergone, you know, a massive expansion, particularly in Europe and in the United States, from 2008 until the present. And it's the conflict between the religious right, the rural religious right, and the secularists, who were pretty much city-bound, okay? And really, that's just another way of describing the right-left, you know, divide in this country. You look at all those counties that Trump won, rural counties. Who supports the blue Democrats? The left coast, the right coast, all along the major city areas. So this kind of a divide, I think, is not due to secularism. It's due to something entirely related to what George Soros and Alinsky and his Rules for Radicals and the Communist Party have created a movement. We can call it wokeness. You can call it what you want. But it's this woke movement that has generated what's happening with BLM and with Antifa, which have found that using violence pays off, and it's been blessed by certain elements within the Democratic Party. Again, these mayors that I mentioned earlier, they did nothing to stop anything going on in Portland or in Minneapolis.
Well, to be fair, they did nothing until they tried to burn down the mayor of Portland's apartment, and then he stabbed once it affected him. And once they broke into the mayor of Seattle's, she stepped up and did something. But once again, you know, is
But my point here is that it's not just secularization. Secularization would sort of be a natural thing. You say, okay, you know, and things happen, and okay, but if you've got a dynamic group of individuals who are determined to, again, what's the word? Fundamentally change America, and they've got an outline with Alinsky. They've got the money from Soros and others. And you see that that's what they're doing. I mean, BLM basically argues for a Marxist revolution. Antifa is revolutionary by its very nature. So, again, what we're arguing on our side is that the Republican form of government that we have, the capitalist free market system, the emphasis on individual rights, not collective rights, have all created an enterprise which is unmatched in world history. And it's not sufficient for these people. Now, you can say, well, why is that? Because of all of the inequities in our society. Okay, I'm sorry, that just doesn't work. There are just too many examples of, particularly, and I've said this before, in terms of this whole argument against BLM and Antifa, you can't look at the civil rights movement of 65 and 64 and 65 without thinking that something fundamental had changed and that opened up the country to a less discriminatory approach to the minorities. And as a result, with past the future legislation from 72 and, you know, affirmative action, those kinds of things which made a difference in creating a black middle class and black entrepreneurs who are in the billionaire status. I mean, how does this happen unless there is a degree of fairness in the system? Now, there's always going to be questions of fairness. I mean, I wish I had retired as a general in the Marine Corps. Gee, I was a good guy. I was really good, but I didn't make general, so it's an unfair system. Oh, BS on that. That's ridiculous, okay? Everyone is going to have a sad story. That's the story of life. So my point here is that it's very hard to argue that the system still retains the kinds of 1950-style discrimination that is hurting the minorities that Dr. King had set out to try to rectify those problems. Now, is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? From my perspective, and from the perspective of black conservatives who live around here, George Williams, for one, who is a major leader in the black conservative movement in the Republican Party, George is in complete agreement with what I'm just telling you, okay? And he's a living example of it. His parents left Mobile in 1955, you know, went to New Jersey. He lived up there. Then he went into the Marines, fought in Vietnam, came back, stayed in the Army Reserve, went into, you know, the federal government as a drug agent, retired at that. George is a self-made man. And I would argue that it's an insult to people like George who have done quite well for themselves. And yet, people from BLM and Antifa are saying, no, the system is completely, you know, unjust. It doesn't wash. And so, you know, that's what I wanted to start the show off with today, and that's, you know, I've succeeded in doing that, but I've spent so much time.
Most of your time. Okay. Well, as they say, communism is a terrible form of government. Most all of the communist governments in history have transitioned out of it.
Yes, I mean, that's quickly
afterward.
Right. Yeah.
With a couple of exceptions, almost all the communist countries that became communist got out of it. However, it is a great way to take power. It's a great way to take paper.
And even these former communist places like Vietnam, you know, they are still run by a communist party that is very, very authoritarian.
But they're totalitarian states now, not communist states. Yeah.
Right. You get this situation with China, and that's the model that seems to be, you know, some of these American woke people think that China is the model to follow. Well, I mean, that doesn't quite fit very well with who we are as a people. And so I think there's a natural reaction to that. That's why this argument that Fareed Zakaria and them are making is that this is a division over secularization doesn't follow, because you've got this small minority that are very woke and very rich and capable of doing bad things, and we're seeing them do it. So I don't buy secularization as the issue. Let me switch real quick to Ukraine, okay?
Yeah.
Mark and I were talking about it a little while ago. The danger with this, and here again, let me just frame this. We have got to stop Putin. There's no question about that. But how we do this without, you know, getting ourselves into not only a war on the ground in Ukraine, but also how do we avoid this Cuban Missile Crisis problem, which is in the history books from 1962, okay? Eyeball to eyeball, Khrushchev and Kennedy, and Khrushchev blinked. Okay, well, Putin's not Khrushchev. Putin has his own problems, and my sense of this is that if he should use weapons of mass destruction in some form, whether it's gas or whether he's so determined that he's not going to lose, he's going to pop a nuke somewhere to make sure that he destroys whatever his obstacle is. And here again, the obstacle that might be there would be Mariupol. I mean, they keep talking about having Mariupol, and they don't. And, you know, today is their victory day for over the war over Germany in 1945. So, I mean, what does he say about the Ukraine? I mean, he's got people who are dying, generals. He's got body bags coming back home. They've had lots of sanctions that have hurt the Russian economy. All of those kinds of things are political problems for Putin. So he's got to come out with a win. Now, how does he do this? Because, really, they've talked about off-ramps. Well, what's his off-ramp? Is it taking Mariupol and the Donbass and calling that victory? Okay, fine. Maybe that's his off-ramp. But guess what? Zelensky and the Ukrainians are saying, not only no, but hell no. We're not giving it up. And we expect NATO and other people to help us stop this. And not just stop it, but take it back and defeat them. So there's Putin's problem. He launches this thing fully expecting to be done in a week. Oops. Now it's into what? The third month. February, March, April, May. Third month. And no success on the horizon. So the temptation for him is to come to some successful conclusion using whatever means he has available. And guess what? They're just bombing the hell out of it. I mean, look at Mariupol. I mean, I've mentioned last week, this is Stalingrad for them, okay? The Ukrainians are holding out week after week after week, and it's killing the Ruskies. And I say, great, but if I'm Putin, I'm going to tell the generals, you know what? I want this over, and I want it over yesterday. I want you to launch a tactical nuke and take this place out. And, you know, they do it. What then? Okay? What then? Now, here's, once again, we get back to Obama and Biden in 2011. Obama basically draws a red line over what happened in Syria. Red line. If Assad uses, you know, gas, sarin, whatever, then that's a red line, and we're going to take action. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. Now, Trump made the same point, and he launched, you know, missiles after the gas storage places in Syria after Assad did it again in 2017, 2018. Okay? So, I mean, there is this deterrence question, and the degree to which Putin looks at Biden, let's see, Afghanistan, nothing. You know? Other things that have happened that really are questionable. The American border. He's letting the border become a porous thing. So in Putin's mind, does he really have an opponent on our side that he has to worry about? I mean, that's the bad thing here, because we don't exhibit the strength that we had under Trump. He's liable to be tempted to pop that nuke in Mariupol or wherever, because he needs a victory. He's got to have something after all of this destruction, death, and economic cost that's taking place. And even though he is Putin, he's got to be concerned about these things. So my argument here is, because you've got someone like him, we don't need to give him an excuse to do something because we're doing something. Giving intelligence and is one thing we can do, but we don't have to tell anyone what we're doing. You know, we can provide the Ukrainians much more in the terms of anti-air defense, whether it's, you know, more Patriots, more whatever. That's what we need to do, and just quietly take care of it. So my fear is that by announcing these kinds of things and the kind of beating our chest, say, oh, yeah, we did it. Well, guess what? The Ruskies are just liable to say, you did it? We're going to do it too. We're going to try to take out something somewhere. And it may just not even be a U.S. ship, but do something, you know, elsewhere. I mean, hell, they've got Moldova right on the border of Ukraine. They're not in NATO. They could take something out on the Moldovans. They could go as far as doing something with the Poles, who are very, very actively engaged in things.
Well, if they go after Poland, then NATO invokes
NATO.
Its treaty, and
yes.
Well, but the United States is part of NATO,
right?
And Russia's really not prepared for a full NATO response at this time.
I would agree, you're right about that.
Over 30% of their total army resources focused on Ukraine.
Exactly.
And they've proven that logistically
they can't hack.
They're
it.
Not ready.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got that, but I would also say, if something like that should happen, then what about NATO? Will NATO respond? I mean, I think that so far the NATO response is fine, because they don't have to worry about a military retaliation. And I think that, you know, this would be a come-to-Jesus moment if something like that happened in Poland, you know? And I think that it's nice to talk about NATO responding, but it's questionable. But be that as it may, my point here is that for the United States, it seems to me that we need to be less open about what we're doing, particularly with intelligence, and not pounding our chests about helping sink, you know, Russian ships. I just don't think it's helpful. If we keep it covert, as much as it's not covert in a covert sense, but it is covert in terms of, you know, supply lines and getting it in and doing what we have to do. Okay.
Okay.
So
let's talk real quick about what happened this weekend.
I will do that, because we're bumping into
Lori's
time.
Yes.
That's right. Borrowed time. That's exactly right. Okay. So this weekend, the first speaker we heard was, you know, Jim Ziegler, who we've endorsed for Secretary of State. And Jim Ziegler was talking about election integrity and problems that even though Alabama has had a very strong rating in terms of 2020 election, we still have some issues. We've been doing, there's a group of people doing canvassing and checking up on these registrations. Okay, so you turn in a registration that says Joe Blow and his family live at whatever. Then you go send people out there to canvass this thing, knock on the door, see who's there. Uh-oh, Joe Blow has 18 people in the house, you know? Wait a second, Joe Blow gave this address, and it's not really a house. It's just an open lot. You know, you have these kinds of anomalies or irregularities as such, okay? There's still, as Jim mentioned, there are still dead people on the rolls that have to be cleaned out. And that is a major undertaking every year. County by county has to do this. So questions about the whole use of absentee ballots, which we opened up considerably because of COVID, but it needs to be curtailed. This mail-in ballot issue is the essence of waiting for fraud to take place. So Jim Ziegler gave that up, and I think that he's going to be strong on all these things, and it was glad to hear him mentioning, the specific issues that he's going to make sure do not become real issues down the road. The next person we heard from was Dr. David Calderwood, one of the major leaders in the concerned doctors movement in Alabama. He stood on the steps of the Supreme Court, basically arguing that what is going on with the use of just big pharma and the various vaccines, that's not the way we need to be doing this. And his major point to us the other day was that we need to have a different way that the public health officials are appointed. The officer that we have, Dr. Harris, he's appointed by the medical board. They do not have an elected responsibility, okay? And so the argument being made here, let's let the governor appoint or make the public health officer an elected official. I mean, we have justices of the Alabama Supreme Court who have to run for office. But his point is, you've got to break this. Unless you break this, you're not going to find a responsive individual who will pay attention to the issues going on. Second thing he said basically was that we have got to pass a law in Alabama that allows doctors to use ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine for treating COVID patients, okay? And he made the point that his doctor's group here, they've treated over 15,000 patients with those COVID patients, and they've only lost 15 people, okay? You see what's going on with the vaccines, the problems with the vaccines. They don't work. They don't prevent you from getting it. And then when you do get it, it's not always going to be effective. And that's another issue there. So his two main points were those. Election reform, you know, so that we've got some control over the public health guys. And you know what's interesting, Mark? That legislature, we defeated this. But they tried to pass a bill that would allow the public health officer, Dr. Harris, send people to jail for not wearing masks. I mean, can you imagine this? This guy is unelected, giving him that kind of power. It's a joke. So we've got to stay vigilant on that. Next person we heard from was Stephanie Dernan, who is from Health. She's the co-director of Health Freedom. She was able to say, look, the tactics we used to get the attention of the state legislators worked. They were very well organized through using text messages to get 400 people to show up at the state house. Common sense was part of that. They did a Jericho walk 7 times around the state house. Then they went up and knocked on their doors, got in the faces of these legislators, and wanted them to pass certain legislation. Now, they didn't pass what we wanted, HB 31. We're going to fight for that, and she's leading the charge on that. Becky Gerritsen was the next person who spoke. She's the executive director of Eagle Forum. She went forward and made the point that the issues that resonate with Alabamians right now are health issues, along with making sure that transgender medications are not allowed for people who are 19 and under. They passed the VCAP bill. It was signed into law. It goes into effect in January. And that's a protection for your children who, if they have feelings about their sexuality, that they're not going to be forced into making, you know, choices that can very easily change down the road. And so the argument for the VCAP thing is that give children a chance to figure out who they are. And if they're still having these kinds of thoughts after they reach a little bit of adulthood at 19, then that's fine. That's a different issue.
Well, yeah, and there's even a TV reality show about a transition person that was transitioned at a young age, and they're actually happy with the transition that they made. However, because they did it at such a young age, they now have permanent disabilities from it.
Well,
And so even though it was what they would have done when they reached a certain age, since they did it before puberty, because of that, they have certain reproductive issues that you know what? They now have a permanent handicap because of it. So waiting till 18, 19.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Is actually in the best interest of the individual, regardless of choice.
Well, so. I mean, you know, you can't buy liquor until, you know, what, 21?
Yeah.
I mean, these kinds of things are suggestive of a system that has some real thought behind mm-hmm. it. Okay. All right. So, Mark, here we are. I will try to fill. I'll fill up the rest of this next week about who else was at our meeting and where we're going with this, because it's important. With 2 weeks to go, we really need to stay on top of the election. So, folks, great week to start with you all. I hope that you have a great week, and hope everything went well for all the mothers out there for yesterday. And like I said at the beginning of this, you know, every day should be Mother's Day, so let's kind of make that happen. Until next week, thank you, Mark. Good seeing you, and God bless, and y'all take care. Bye.
Thank you, Dr. Lou. You've been listening to Dr. Lou Campomanosi, president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This has been paid for by Kevin Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell Station in Malvis with a brand new state-of-the-art car wash. Dr. Lou will be back next week. We'll stick around for that. In the meantime, you're listening to 1480 WABF.
Listen for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review, paid talk show, Monday mornings at 10:05 with Dr. Lou Campomanosi.